afternoon on the right whale speed rule and on-demand fishing, and we have Dr. Good and Dr. Asaro, and I think you guys are both online. Yeah, we're gonna unmute you right now.
Yeah, hi there, this is Caroline Good.
I can barely hear.
Can you hear me?
We can barely hear you. If you could just get a little closer to your mic, we'll turn the volume up here as well. Mr. Asaro, are you with us?
Sure. Is that better?
Yes, ma'am. That's fine. Dr. Asaro?
Okay.
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, whoever's first, go ahead.
I'll go ahead. Thank you very much. You can go to the next slide. Thank you. As you're all very well aware, the current North Atlantic right whale population continues to decline, and the species is approaching extinction, again, primarily due to elevated levels of mortality and serious injury from entanglement fishing gear and collisions with vessels. Our current preliminary estimates indicate fewer than 350 individuals remain. That's fewer actually than the 368 even indicated here on the slide. And we also have less than 100 reproductively active females left in the population. Since 2017, when we declared an unusual mortality event for the species, scientists have documented now 54 right whales killed or seriously injured in the United States and Canadian waters, which I should also say, according to our best abundance models, actually accounts for only about a third of the actual right whale life and deaths during this time period. Next slide. To address this crisis, NOAA Fisheries has developed a living strategy initiative entitled The Road to Recovery to focus resources on key threats to the species and monitor the health of the population, emerging threats, and the effectiveness of our actions. Next slide. Today, I'm going to focus specifically on our efforts just to further reduce the lethal, the risk, I should say, of lethal vessel strikes to right whales. Next slide. As most of you are aware, right whales inhabit U.S. waters year-round, but predominate during the late fall through early summer, when nearly the entire right whale population may be found within U.S. waters. This map on the right shows all right whale sightings between 2010 and 2021 along the East Coast, although I will note that these are not corrected for search effort and so are not representative of whale densities in certain areas, such as off Florida and Georgia, and in the Gulf of Maine has more comprehensive survey effort than, for example, the Mid-Atlantic. Right whales, given this coastal distribution, are highly vulnerable to vessel strike, in part because they frequently occur at near surface depths. This is a real issue for females, for example, with young calves, and also for whales engaged in certain activities such as surface feeding during the winter and early spring months as well. Next slide. This visualization illustrates the problem that right whales encounter along our highly urbanized East Coast. The blue dots show vessel traffic along the New York, New Jersey coast over a 5-day period in March of 2021. And the red dot is the concurrent migration of a 1-year-old right whale, which was satellite tagged by scientists at HDR as part of a US Navy study. And you can just see how this illustrates the extensive vessel traffic that these whales are encountering daily within their primary habitats along the coast. Next slide. So just to cap the current right whale speed rule, we first implemented vessel speed restrictions in 2008, and the current speed rule requires most vessels 65 feet or longer to transit at or under 10 knots within designated seasonal management areas. The map here shows the location and the timing for each of those current SMAs. The speed rule exempts certain vessel categories, including military vessels, federally owned or operated vessels, and vessels that are actively engaged in law enforcement or search and rescue activities. Additionally, the rule includes an important safety deviation provision, which allows vessels to exceed the 10 knot speed limit in certain circumstances if they encounter severe maneuverability constraints. Next slide. Concurrent with implementation of the 2008 rule, we also launched a voluntary dynamic management area program whereby all vessels are requested to slow their speed to 10 knots or less when transiting through temporary zones declared when three or more right whales are sighted in proximity outside of these active seasonal management areas. The agency has since added acoustic detection of right whales as a means of triggering these DMAs, or also called slow zones. And this map shows the location of all 67 dynamic areas and slow zones declared during 2021. However, our most recent analyses indicate that vessel cooperation with this voluntary program remains poor. And when the program was initially established, the agency indicated at the time that we would revisit the potential need for mandatory dynamic speed restrictions if mariner cooperation remains low over time. Next slide. So we are proposing four categories of amendments to the current right whale speed rule to ensure a substantial reduction in lethal strike risk for right whales. First, we are proposing changes to the spatial and temporal boundaries of the seasonal management areas that we would rename as seasonal speed zones for greater clarity. Second, we would broaden the size class of vessels subject to speed restriction to include most vessels greater than or equal to 35 feet in length or longer. A third, we're proposing to create a new dynamic speed zone program to provide discrete temporary speed restrictions for right whales outside of these proposed seasonal speed zones. And finally, we're also proposing some updates to the current safety deviation provision. Next slide. So let me first walk you through the new proposed seasonal speed zones. This map shows the seasonal speed zones, or SSZs, in solid colors, along with the existing seasonal management area boundaries for reference illustrated by the dotted lines. This map is also available on our website, too, also as a GIS file, if that's a help. Expansion of the mandatory seasonal speed zones is needed to address a misalignment between the current SMAs in areas and times of elevated vessel strike risk. Since 2008, right whales have modified their distribution and habitat use along the U.S. coast, rendering the current boundaries and timing inadequate to provide sufficient protection. To better address the issue, we developed a coast-wide vessel strike risk model using the latest available data on right whale distribution and vessel traffic characteristics, which I should note is much more comprehensive than the data that was available to us in 2008. We were able to include information as well on vessel traffic in the 35 to 65 foot length class, although this data is more limited due to the less frequent use of automatic identification system or AIS devices by vessels in this size class. Separately, we also considered how the location of future wind energy development and possible U.S. Coast Guard shipping safety fairways might impact strike risk moving forward. While the proposed changes include a combination of spatial and temporal expansion and contraction in some areas, overall the changes would approximately double the area under speed restriction along the coast, with the modifications disproportionately impacting the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic regions where there is a substantial spatio-temporal strike risk that remains unaddressed by the current boundaries. Next slide. A second important change to the speed rule is the addition of most vessels 35 feet or longer to the size class of vessels that are subject to regulation. Vessels in this size class remain unregulated despite their involvement in documented right whale serious injury and mortality cases. It may come as a surprise to many, quite frankly, that these smaller vessels could kill an animal as large as a whale, but unfortunately, they do remain an ongoing threat and are lethal just as large ocean-going ships are, and so we've found that we need to better address this risk. So to give you an idea of the strike events that documented, vessels between 17 and 54 feet in length operating in U.S. waters have reported 8 right whale strikes since 2005. 6 of these strike events were lethal, and 2 resulted in non-serious injuries to right whales. Additionally, We've also have an additional 6 strikes reported by vessels in this size class involving undetermined large whale species that may have included right whales based on the location and the timing of those events. I'll also note that in 7 of the 8 confirmed right whale strikes, boat operators reported never seeing the whales prior to impact, and in some cases, the vessels sustained significant damage. And I'll highlight here that really means that preventing these strikes is a matter of safety, both for the whales and for these smaller sized vessels, also for the vessel and passengers on board. Right whales in U.S. waters, as I said earlier, are particularly vulnerable to vessel traffic in this size class due to the overall density and speed of this traffic and the frequency with which right whales occur at the surface and often close to shore. Speed regulation for vessels under 65 feet is also already underway in some places to reduce right whale collisions. The state of Massachusetts currently implements a 10-knot speed restriction for most vessels under 65 feet in Cape Cod Bay each March and April. And Canada also has a 10-knot speed limit in the Gulf of St. Lawrence between April and November for vessels 13 meters or approximately 42 feet or longer. Next slide. In addition to the vessel size class changes, we recognize the need for additional protection for right whales outside the proposed seasonal speed zones. The proposed dynamic speed zones are designed to protect right whale presence and aggregations in small areas over limited periods of time. These would be triggered when we confirm either visual or acoustic right whale detections outside of the seasonal speed zones and determine that there's a greater than 50% likelihood that the whales will remain within that area. Once triggered, these dynamic speed zones would be announced via NOAA Fisheries website, U.S. Coast Guard broadcast notices to mariners, weather service alerts, whale app, email lists. We would make sure to do everything we can to get the word out to mariners, and we would also publish a notice in the Federal Register as well. The expansion of the seasonal speed zones, however, is likely to substantially reduce the overall need for these dynamic zones, and we anticipate that most dynamic zones, if declared, would occur in the mid-Atlantic and northeast. Just to give you an example, this map here again shows those 67 voluntary, which is again a different program, voluntary DMA and slow zones that were declared in 2021. And I've highlighted in pink those zones that potentially might have been declared under this new program had the new seasonal speed zones been in effect last year. So it gives you a sense of where they may have occurred. Next slide. Finally, we are proposing updates to the speed rule safety deviation provision to enhance mariner safety, aid monitoring, and help with enforcement of the rule. And these are primarily three key changes. First, expansion of the safety deviation to include emergency situations that present a threat to the health or safety or life of a person. So if there's a medical emergency, someone's broken a leg, having a heart attack, they can speed into the port as needed. Second, we are proposing modifications to the existing reporting protocols. So currently, mariners must make a notation in their vessel logbook when employing the safety deviation. And we are proposing to eliminate this requirement and instead require mariners to submit an electronic report to NIPS within 48 hours of employing the safety deviation, detailing the circumstances and need for the deviation as they would currently do in the logbook. This will allow us to better understand where and when mariners are experiencing safety issues, which vessel types are involved, and also help us better monitor compliance with the rule. Finally, the proposed changes also would add a new provision just for vessels in the 35 to 65 foot size class, allowing them to transit at speeds in excess of 10 knots within areas where the National Weather Service has declared a gale warning or greater wind warning for wind speeds exceeding those that would trigger a gale warning. No reporting of these weather deviations would be required. This change recognizes the potential special safety needs of these smaller vessels, especially commercial and industrial vessels that are most likely to need to be out on the water during potential severe weather events. Lastly, I also want to touch on enforcement. This is a very important consideration given the totality of the proposed changes. NOAA recognizes the need for enforcement planning, and we've already taken additional proactive steps, including upgrading capabilities for tracking vessel speed at sea, initiating research of new vessel tracking technologies. We've investigated land-based and aerial monitoring options, and we've also begun some staff-level discussions with the U.S. Coast Guard regarding the possibility of modifying the current AIS carriage requirements to include additional vessel types and sizes. Next slide. We completed an economic assessment of the proposed changes and to estimate the impacts to different vessel types. We estimate that just under 16,000 vessels would potentially be affected by the proposed amendments at an estimated cost of over $46 million per year. Of the impacted vessels, we estimate that 59% are recreational or pleasure boats, 22% ocean-going or commercial ships, and 19% are other vessel types, including commercial and industrial vessels, passenger vessels, etc. I should note that the number of affected vessels less than 65 feet in length may be substantially overestimated. We tried to take a conservative and inclusive approach when estimating the number of possibly impacted vessels in this size class, given that many of these vessels do not carry AIS devices, thus limiting the data that was available to estimate vessel activity. Overall, large ocean-going commercial ships would continue to bear the majority of costs, which is consistent with what we see the current speed rule. Approximately 89% of the costs would accrue to vessels operating in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. Again, this regional depends on the larger overall expansion of the seasonal speed zones needed in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic region to address the elevated strike risk there. Finally, we do expect that certain vessel types, such as many commercial fishing vessels and, for example, sailboats, that may be newly subject to speed regulation will be less impacted or minimally impacted because they are already transiting at speeds that are equal to or less than 10 knots as part of their regular normal operation. So just because a vessel is going to be subject to speed restriction does not always mean that that vessel is heavily impacted by that regulation. Next slide. I just want to make sure everyone is aware that we obviously welcome and appreciate comments on the rule. We have recently extended our comment deadline till October 31st of this year. Given the right whale status, we are aiming to finalize changes to the rule as soon as possible. And we are trying to work as closely as possible with the maritime community to obviously minimize burdens on regulated vessels while providing these essential vessel strike risk reductions to right whales. I do want to note, too, that we remain open to the development of potential future technologies that could help with vessel strike avoidance. You know, we very much are open-minded about the fact that there may be additional tools and options in the future that could allow for different kinds and types of management. And lastly, I just want to really stress the seriousness of the right whale situation. You know, this is a species that's at manifest risk of extinction. And, you know, it's worth noting here that oftentimes there's been many tools used by scientists to successfully forestall extinction in other vulnerable species, you know, captive breeding programs or relocation of animals to safer habitats. And none of this is available to us. These are the kinds of threats that can only be addressed out in the wild on the ocean. These are, very sparse events, and they need to be addressed along the entire coast. And that is why we have moved forward proposing these necessary steps. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Doctor. So any questions or comments from the council? Mr. Salerno.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the presentation, and I'm glad to see that the agency is really putting an effort into addressing the vessel strike issue. Obviously, the potential is you're expanding your slope bait, for lack of a better word, slow zones. You're lowering the vessel size that this would apply to. It sounds like you're investing into better enforcement technology, increased enforcement technology. I guess my question is, how are you going to increase compliance? I think there was a very strong bullet point in there that said there's very low compliance with it. You know, just because you're putting more areas in and lowering the limit, that doesn't mean we're going to get at the compliance question. So I'm just curious, some thoughts around the compliance part. Thank you.
Sure, sure. So first of all, let me clarify one thing. So when I was noting that there was a low level of cooperation, that was cooperation levels with our voluntary current dynamic management area and slow zone programs. Our overall compliance with our current mandatory seasonal management areas is just over 81% of vessel transit distance. And so I want to separate out sort of cooperation with voluntary versus compliance with mandatory. But again, we want to up those numbers for our mandatory zones. And so we are, first of all, reviewing the information that we have about where and when we have current compliance issues. We're going to be conducting a significant amount of outreach as well regarding vessel types or regions that we may need to work with more closely on compliance. Again, as I did mention, NOAA OLE has been doing a lot of pre-planning for enhancement of compliance. It'll also make it easier for us to, one of the, you know, the changes that we're making, that we're proposing, I should say, to the safety deviation provision by having vessels report into us. That's going to be very helpful for us to both monitor where we're having safety issues, first of all, which is would be really helpful, but also to help with compliance. Because right now, for example, if a vessel is speeding, and let's say we can see that in AIS data, we don't necessarily know that that particular track is a violation of the current speed rule, because we then have to contact the vessel operator and ask if they, you know, employed a safety deviation, because it's something that they at this point would only need to note in their vessel logbook. So that will make it much easier for us to be able to better monitor as well, both compliance as well as safety issues with the rule. So we're confident that we'll be able to up our overall compliance numbers, because again, that's absolutely essential. That's the only way that this will be effective and provide effective protection for right whales.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I'm trying not to be pessimistic here, but your seasonal speed zones, as you stated in here, you're more than doubling the area, and you know, previous they were pretty much around the port location, so you would figure these vessels are slowing down as they're coming into the port locations, but these are significant seasonal speed zone areas. Now I'm looking at the Atlantic one, basically from North Carolina all the way up around Cape Cod to, it looks like, basically Gloucester. I mean, that's a huge area where I just hope that your efforts will ensure that compliance does stay as high it is. But thank you for that.
Mr. Bellavance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Good, for your presentation. I have a question and a comment, if I may. My question is, I haven't read the proposed rule entirely, so I'm not sure if it's in there or not, but is there a formula for measuring vessel length?
A formula for it, the vessel length would be the length overall, and that would be consistent also with how U.S. Coast Guard would measure vessel lengths. So when we're saying 35 feet or above, that is length overall.
Okay, so not documented length, which is the waterline, right? So just want to make sure.
Correct.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. And then just a quick comment in sort of along where Mr. Salerno was referencing, and that's the enforcement and the equity of a rule. So I'm in the recreational for hire industry, and time fishing is something that anglers in our business take seriously and flock to boats that go faster. And I can recall during one of the mandatory closures last year, a social media post where clients on charter boats were commenting on a post that they should go with this one particular person because he's not following the speed rules and the other guys are, so you get less fishing time. So those are the types of things that I'm worried about from an equity perspective as you develop the rule, and just to keep that in mind. Thank you.
No, I appreciate that, and thank you for making that comment. Again, I'm not permitted by our Office of Law Enforcement to get into specific details about some additional enforcement efforts that we may be launching. But that is something that we're very sensitive to. And I fully understand what you're talking about. I come from a very big sport fishing family myself. I've fished all along the coast, so I know exactly the issue you mean.
Mr. Tracy, then Mr. Pierdnuck.
I'm all set, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Mr. Pierdnuck, then Ms. Ware.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Doctor, for your presentation. Myself, as well as the public, appreciate the fact that the comment period was extended. One of the reasons for such was that the estimated economic numbers that were presented, we feel need to be validated. For instance, there's a closure proposed from November 1st to May 31st up here from northern Massachusetts all the way down to Virginia. The maritime industry, recreational for-hire, and commercial fleet, depending upon the location, could be significantly impacted as a result of a 10-knot speed limit. What I find hard to understand is that if the right whales are located, let's say, off of Virginia, why such a restriction would take place up here. And that I agree there needs to be measures in place to protect them, but to implement such speed restrictions over such a large area is going to have a detrimental impact on that blue economy, depending upon the location. In addition, one thing that's continues to change up here with increased temperatures is that we're fishing later in the season, depending upon the location. During that time period, there are those that are going haddock fishing, commercial bluefin tuna fishing, and as we go farther south, black sea bass fishing, tog fishing, summer flounder fishing, and so on. In addition, depending upon your location and months of the year, you would transit to the canyons, and those boats aren't even going to leave the dock because of the distance is such that at a 10-knot speed limit, it's not going to work. My understanding from a presentation or the discussion a few days ago by the Coast Guard, they have the means and methods to determine the speed limit independent of AIS. So the technology already exists. I would hope that if there's a consideration that the economic impact that would be, or the economic impact to the entire blue economy with such a closure justifies the need to spend the money that's needed to provide the technology to identify where the whales are located in order to have, which right now we have a rolling closure, but it's a recommended closure. So you can close an area as they move up the coast. We have the technology now that you can see heat signatures in the water, and that you could use such technology to, either through drones or satellites, to understand where they are because they have to come up for air. Implement an appropriate buffer distance in addition to where you identify that, and implement that closure and have it rolling. That time of year that, for instance, where you have that closure, you're going to have serious mariners on the water in general, and they're going to be listening to the forecast, they're going to be listening to Channel 16, and they're going to be listening to that information of where those whales are located. So I hope that these measures are implemented, but it's limited to a specific location, consistent with the technology that we have, and that we spend the money that's needed for that technology if it's lacking. Taking into consideration, I think you already have a $46 million number. I suspect it is much higher than that. And as a result, it justifies the expenditure to do that, so it keeps that blue economy going. Thank you.
Ms. Ware, then Mr. Aristad. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Doctor.
I just want to make just two clarifications. First of all, I obviously very much encourage you to submit this as a formal comment. But I just wanted to clarify two things. One is that we are not, I want to just make it 100% clear, we're not implementing closures anywhere. There is nothing in the proposed regulation that restricts where or when a vessel can transit, only the speeds at which certain vessels may transit in certain times and areas. So I just want to be very clear about that. The other thing I just want to say overall, with regards to sort of the size and the breadth of the zones, those were, again, all based on the most recent data that we have about vessel traffic and right whale distribution. I will say that, believe me, I very much wish that we could say, oh, look, all of these strikes are happening in this one little discrete area or season and just address a small problem. But what we are seeing in the data, both from the strike information that we have as well as the modeling, is that this is a diffuse coast-wide problem. And that is why we have had to implement a solution that follows that the data and information and analyses that we have. So I just want to just to clarify those two things. Thank you.
Ms. Ware, then Mr. Aristad.
Thank you. Thank you, Caroline, for the presentation. I have two questions. My first is kind of building off of the questions about enforcement. It's great to hear that there's some pre-planning from OLE, and I think in our OLE presentation earlier today, we heard about, or earlier this week, we heard about some of the new research or technologies. My question is, has that pre-planning or those new technologies been extended to state enforcement personnel?
I know that OLE is working with state partners, but I don't want to get outside of my personal remit and discuss the details of any of those discussions because I wouldn't want to misspeak on that.
Okay.
Hold on, Megan. Mr. Oh. Gilbert, you want to?
Yeah, great.
Sorry to interrupt. I would just corroborate what Dr. Good suggested. Yes, state enforcement is involved with all of our planning discussions. As far as technology, I can't speak to that, but they will be involved in speed enforcement related operations.
Ms. Ware.
Great, thank you. That's great to hear. I know when I've talked with Patrol, their comment was that they don't have a mechanism to enforce speed restrictions in real time. And I suspect other states may have that same issue. So I just want to raise that, particularly since state enforcement in Maine, I'll speak, has a pretty large presence. And then my second question was about the dynamic speed restrictions. And I know listening to other webinars on this, kind of a key element of that is that 50% likelihood that whales remain in the zone. And my sense is that methodology hasn't been developed yet. And I'm just curious how NOAA plans to engage stakeholders as maybe a little more meat to the bone and details get added to that dynamic framework and specifically that 50% likelihood.
Sure. So our analyses that are looking at the existing acoustic and sightings data that we have for right whales will inform the again, the science and modeling behind that determination of whether or not these animals are likely to remain present during those areas. And I'll say that it's an important component too, because if we are saying to a mariner, you are required, this is now mandatory within this dynamic zone to go 10 knots or less, or to avoid that area potentially, that we want to make sure that whales are likely to be around and that there's something to be protected. And so that's why that additional component, first of all, was added. But in term, we definitely, Megan, are soliciting if there are comments or people have suggestions about how they would like to see that determined or suggestions for the analysis. We welcome that during the comment period, but we will not be accepting additional comment on the modeling and other things that would ultimately support that after October 31st.
Okay, thank you. I'll just end by saying, I think, you know, a key to that dynamic framework is just gonna be really clear transparency on how that closure got triggered and why it's being implemented. So anything that we can do to be very transparent in the methodology or the reasoning, I think will will aid that program. So thank you.
Fully agreed. We're putting steps in place for exactly that reason. We want to be very clear what went into it, how the decision was made, and make sure it's extremely clear to people how those particular zones are determined.
Mr. Arstead.
Yes, thank you. So my question has to do with the figure on slide 14, which I think is the previous slide. First of, and I apologize if I missed this from the presentation, but the figure seems to break down the various costs by vessel type. If you just maybe quickly explain how that was calculated, because I don't quite understand it. But my second part of the question is simply to what category of vessel type are in fact party charter boat and commercial vessel fishing vessels assigned, because that's not very clear either. Thank you.
Sure. So first of all, commercial fishing vessels actually are that tiny little blue slice at the top. So they are make up a very small portion of the total estimated yearly cost. Within the passenger vessel category falls a lot of different types of vessels that would include, for example, tour boats. It would include ferry vessels. It would include charter fishing vessels, potentially. And these different vessel type categories are based on the categories as vessels are required to report themselves in to the U.S. Coast Guard via AIS. So that we were following some of those similar, essentially, we amalgamated for commercial shipping. We amalgamated, tankers and cargo vessels and sort of those larger categories together. But that is how those vessel categories came together. So in terms of a charter or headboats, they would be included under passenger vessels as opposed to commercial fishing vessels.
Anyone else from the council? Anyone from the audience? Anyone online? Mr. Pierdnock.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused by the cost of the impacts of the impacts of the impacts of the impacts of the impacts.